So most people in here are, at least whether you know it or not, are kind of trained as engineering and technical students, and most people feel pretty comfortable with that. Here's a textbook, homework, homework, test, and then, you know, we lecture on it. Some very specific ideas or equations or things like that, and I think you'll see a lot of that this week and the beginning of next when we talk about engineering economics. You'll see a little bit less of that when we talk about energy and sustainability rating systems and things like that. But so we'll kind of drift in and out of what I would consider more traditional engineering type things and more traditional and things you might see more other parts of the campus here that don't deal with engineering. So this week, I think, will be very familiar to you, at least the way it's set up. So look at, when you look at each week, this is what you should expect to see. At the top, you'll see the basic topic and the learning objectives. Take a moment to look at those learning objectives because we've thought about those. And that's what we expect you to get or hope that you get out of this particular topic. So when you're listening and going, what the heck do they want me to know? Go back to here. This states in reasonable terms what we expect you to get out of this. Then you'll see if there are a number of whatever lectures are associated with that topic. You can do whatever you want with those. You can download them, print them out, bring them on your laptop, annotate them when you're in class taking notes. You can take notes. And on the back end, you can then go download and look at the lecture slides again and fill in the details. Whatever works best for you, right? So we've given you lots of opportunities or lots of choices, and then you get to figure out how you want to use them best. But we'll have those notes up there. Typically, we'll put them up in advance. For some of the guest speakers, like Professor Hanlon, they'll go up basically after the lecture when we get those lecture slides. Then there will be the assignment, if there is one. If there's no assignment, we will try and make sure that it says no assignment, like it did in week one. Note there are two assignments this week. One is due on Wednesday. That's just the online diagnostic survey. There are 51 responses I checked about an hour ago. So, you know, about a third are in. So I'm looking for more than about 40% are in. So I'm looking for the other ones. So make sure you do that. That's an easy assignment. You just got to do it. And the engineering economics assignment is due on April 20th. It's right here in PDF format. It just basically says do some problems from the book. For the most part, about half of those problems actually have the answer given to at least one part or the problem in general. My goal is for you to be able to do those problems. And oftentimes, it's a lot easier to figure out how to do a problem if you actually have the answer sitting in front of you. So then when you know you have the same answer, you probably figure, well, I probably have it down and I can do it. So that's the idea. So that's the homework assignment for engineering economics. And then there's the required media, which is, you know, used to be called required reading, but now you can watch videos and things like that. So media. There's an engineering economics textbook, like I said, that's online that you can access through Novel. They value my opinion, but I don't value their asking. And you can download the book chapter for chapter right here, including the homework assignment, all the details in each chapter, and what you will probably want to have at some point is Appendix B, end of period compound interest tables, and I'll show you some examples of that today. But this is the site you should be able to get to. This is textbook that's included with your student fees, meaning that the university library subscribes to this site and it's available with that subscription. So, yay! Otherwise, this costs $140. So, you know, free $140, same information. I made a choice, and hopefully, it's a good one. Let's see, what else about week two? We'll go back to the And the only other thing is there may be other pieces of required media. Like, I just asked you to read this short little article from the New York Times in February of 2011 because I think it demonstrates the power of a life cycle cost analysis, which we'll end up with in this engineering economics part. And it deals with how Boeing won the latest round of the Air Force tanker wars with EADS and all their subsidiaries. But suffice it to say, the bottom line was actually life cycle cost and some things that a couple of, or at least one in particular representative from the state of Washington got them to include in their evaluation. So just an example of how life cycle cost can win your state $35 billion in tanker orders. How many of you guys here have actually had an engineering economics class? Okay, so look around. If you're raising your hand, everybody's going to ask you for the answer. Okay, and I took a quick look online, and of the 51 responses we had, 1 through 5, 1 being don't know anything about it, 5 being I got it, the most popular response was number 2, so I know something about it, but not much, 43%. 3 and 4 were tied, about 20, 18% each. So there appears to be some knowledge, but hopefully we'll go from there. Those of you who had an engineering economics class, you got this one in the bag, right? We're going to go over engineering economics in a week and a half. We're not going to spend a whole quarter. It's the University of Washington. We're smart here. We would do it in a day, but yeah, we'll wait for a foreign level class for that. Okay. So that's kind of the background for this week and a part of next. And so in the middle of next week, the way we have it scheduled now, Wednesday, Professor Mahoney will come in and start talking about energy. And then engineering economics will be due April 20th. When the homework's due, you can read the course concepts. If you forget all the stuff that I'm talking about right now, you just do bring it into class, turn it in ahead of time. Before class starts, I'll have a big pile up here to take back and read. That's how it works. We still collect homework in a very traditional manner. Okay. So this is a little bit about engineering economics. And starting from week one, I introduced this topic by saying, you know, everything you do in civil engineering is going to cost money. If you don't know the basics regarding money, then you're at a severe disadvantage because you probably don't know how decisions are being made regarding your project or whatever you're working on. So this is a little introduction to engineering economics, and this is kind of what I feel or what we feel that you ought to know as a civil engineer. And we go through it reasonably fast, but we spend some time doing example problems and whatnot. So, you know, feel free to stop me if you need anything further explained, and so on and so forth. So our learning objectives, what we're going to do with this first one, this first series of slides, is we'll basically define some basic terms, including cost, time, value of money, inflation, risk, interest, discount rate, those kinds of things, and then work through some basic problems in computing present worth, equivalent annual worth, internal rate of return, those kinds of things. And then during the next chunk of slides, I've broken it up into two chunks, we'll talk about how to use those kinds of things to evaluate projects or alternatives, which is kind of where it's at for engineering economics, especially for civil engineers. You know, even if you never have to deal with economics again in your chosen field, if you actually want to pass the FE exam or the PE exam, you got to deal with engineering economics again. I teach a review course for the professional engineers exam, and we just went over all this stuff last Thursday, and it shows up from time to time. So these kinds of things, which you could argue are sort of really big engineering pieces of infrastructure that civils have a really big part in. Here's the new Tacoma Narrows Bridge. That was darn near $1 billion, completed about 3 years ago. But it's $1 billion of infrastructure right there. And what drives this getting made, when it's made, and how it's made is oftentimes not the engineering details, but the economics surrounding it. And we're talking about big sums of money, right? This is the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge. It's the north side, so Yerba Buena Island to Oakland-ish. That's $6.3 billion. They're all the way down to building this little piece here, which is their signature self-anchored suspension bridge, which has cost them a ton of money. But so this part's done already. And then when they're done, they're going to knock down the old bridge, which is roughly right here. This is the tallest building in the world, so if you've got kids in, you know, 8 to 10 years old, tallest, biggest, widest, fastest is always important, but it's also $800 million worth of building. So again, these kinds of things, when you build them, how you build them, are often determined by financing and not necessarily engineering limitations. So you got to know something about money. And the things that you build actually have really big impacts if you can get past the money part. Where's my Icelandic speaking person here? Kind of shady. You know, geothermal plant, yeah, I know, I'll be able to do the first time, all right? It's a geothermal plant in southwest Iceland that has a potential for producing 300 megawatts of electrical and 400 megawatts of thermal geothermal energy. And it turns out Iceland, one of their biggest exports is power, right? Because they actually have lots of geothermal resources. They're located on the Atlantic ridgeline, and they also have lots of water resources. And so most of their power is really cheap and really clean, geothermal and hydro. It turns out of all the power they generate in Iceland, about 10% is actually used by the population for living. The other 90% goes to aluminum smelting, mostly. They operate a couple of big smelter plants. That's one way to export electricity, so to speak. They actually run a lot of thermal, too, so you basically get your hot water from underground. Pretty interesting. So all those projects, all that stuff, the financial component is really big. The principles are pretty straightforward, though. Here's what they are. So if you were to define engineering economics, right, this is always a good place to start. Application of economic techniques to evaluation of design and engineering alternatives. So how do we evaluate different alternatives? Generally, when you're talking engineering economics, you're talking about evaluating these things over their total life. So that includes initial construction, maintenance, replacement, rehabilitation, administrative efforts, user costs, so on and so forth. Not just initial construction costs. We tend to get locked in civil on initial construction costs. I can ask you, how much does this 520 bridge out here cost? You can look it up online, the answer is about $4.5 billion. That's initial construction costs. That's not how much that bridge costs, right? There are operating costs, maintenance costs, all sorts of other things as well. So if you break down the types of costs you typically talk about, there's a fixed cost. That's really a constant cost regardless of output or activity. It's an all or nothing cost. And an example might be construction administration. And it doesn't matter how much you're building, you have to have some certain amount of overhead for administration. And it's either there or it's not. So that's a fixed cost. And it doesn't really vary by the size of what you're doing or the amount of what you're doing. What varies by the amount of what you're doing is the variable cost. And that, like I said, cost on the amount of output or activity. So an example there would be construction labor costs. The more output you want, the more you want to build, the more construction labor you hire, the more you pay for that. So that's a variable cost. And then kind of what is oftentimes referred to as the marginal cost. Marginal cost is the variable cost for one more unit. So basically, where you're at, what does it cost to get one more? So another way to think of this, actually went to go see Cedar Rapids last week. You guys seen Cedar Rapids? It's a funny movie. Ed Helms. Good movie. But so you go to the theater and you could buy a bag of popcorn for like $5, right? But for only a dollar more, you can get a trash can full of popcorn. So in that case, the marginal cost is really low, right? You've got a bucket this size, but for $5, but for a dollar more, I can get a bucket about yay big. Okay, so what they're doing is appealing to your sense of what this marginal cost is, and you're saying, wow, for only a dollar more, for just one more unit in this case, one more unit might be another 3 pounds of popcorn. It's only costing me a dollar. That's a really good marginal cost. I'm going to go for it because I'm American and I'm prone to overconsume. Like, and usually the trash can size is unlimited, right? You can take it back and get another trash can for free. So depending on how desperate you are, you can go into the theater and find an empty trash can. Or you can pay the extra dollar. So they're appealing to this marginal cost being so low, right? Because they know all you really want is $5 worth of popcorn. they can suck another dollar out of you. That popcorn costs them nearly nothing. So that's that idea of marginal cost. How much does it cost for one more? Right? They're all required to ask you that when you buy popcorn and soda, right? You can get the bucket of soda. Like the small in a movie theater is like this big. Crazy. The small has disappeared from American culture. Like how much is, I mean, when you go to a vending machine, how much soda do you get? 20 ounces. Ouch. Okay, so that's a marginal cost. Now, sunk cost is the other one. This is the one that some people might have trouble with. But sunk cost is money already spent as a result of a past decision. It's ignored in engineering economic analysis because it is irrelevant. And here's my example that people have issues with sunk cost. So you buy season tickets to the Seahawks. And you find out as the season progresses that they totally suck. This is not far-fetched. In week 14 of the season, a friend invites you to go to a Husky basketball game against Gonzaga. You can hope. They should play each other, right? But they don't. At the same time that the Seahawks are playing in Quest Field, which is now going to be renamed eventually for whoever bought Quest. Do you go to the Seahawks game anyway because you already bought the ticket? Does the price of the advanced ticket purchase play into your decision? Like, oh, I already bought the ticket, I should go. And caring about the cost of the Hawks ticket is what economists would call irrational behavior. It's inefficient because it misallocates resources by depending on information that is irrelevant to the decision being made. In English, base your decision on the choice at hand. Don't compound a poor financial decision by forcing yourself to watch a terrible game. Right? So you purchase that Seahawks ticket. That's done. So somebody comes and says, hey, you want to go watch the basketball game. If you're going to go for free, you're basically comparing a Seahawks ticket versus a basketball game ticket straight up. Whether you spent the 19 or 20 or 50 bucks on the Seahawks ticket, it's irrelevant. Does that make sense? It's a difficult concept to get a hold of. But it's essential that we don't consider sunk cost. Just because you spent a bunch of money on a bad decision doesn't mean you need to keep pouring money into that decision and somehow justify it. All you do is waste more money. This is why projects sometimes get canceled after you've spent millions of dollars on them, when you finally realize this is a bad decision, we need to stop. Right? It's not unlike relationships. We don't talk about those kinds of things. You've got to go sort of up by Red Square and in the quad to talk about those kinds of things. But there are a lot of really good classes in those subjects as well. So opportunity cost. So we got fixed, variable, marginal, sunk, and opportunity cost. Opportunity cost is the cost associated with using a resource, equipment, manpower, cash, those kinds of things, in one activity instead of another. So oftentimes you're faced with choices. And by using your resources in one way, you give up the benefits of using it in another way, right? So if you got 20 bucks, you can only buy one ticket. You got to go to one place. You can't go to everywhere. You can't do everything. So one way to look at opportunity cost is, let's go buy a couple of sports tickets again, is you got a ticket to a basketball game and a football game. If you decide to go to the football game, perhaps your opportunity cost is the cost of that basketball game ticket. Because you don't get to use your 20 bucks to buy two tickets. You've got to pick. You give up the benefits of that other choice that you chose not to take. And an incremental cost really is just the difference in cost between alternatives. And ultimately, in engineering economics, when you're comparing alternatives and trying to figure out which one is better from an economic standpoint, really all you care about is the incremental cost. The things that cost the same for both alternatives, you don't even need to think about. It doesn't matter. You're really looking at the differences, right? So that's the incremental cost. Okay. Questions so far? Good. All right, so we got time value of money. So let me ask you this. If I asked you guys to lend me $100, each of you, and I pay you back in a year $100. You guys know, of course, that I'm going on sabbatical in the fall to Rome for 6 weeks, a few other places. Would you lend me the money? You don't really know me from Adam right now. I mean, you know, honestly, think about it. Would you lend me the money? And if the question is, gee, I don't know, what causes you to say, gee, I don't know? Or no way, it looks like a total sleaze ball. And it's the time value of money that's making you think about this. Right? Giving up $100 now to get $100 back in a year and a half doesn't seem like much of a deal. Why is that? Well, so the time value of money. Money has value over time. A dollar today, a dollar a year from now, and a dollar 10 years from now all differ in value. Why is that? And there's three reasons. Inflation, risk, and the cost of money. So we'll go over each of these now. So this is why money has value in relation to time. So inflation. Inflation is a decrease in the buying power of a unit of currency, for instance, a dollar. Or you could say it's an increase in the general level of prices. This inflation is the reason that your parents say, when I was your age, a candy bar cost 25 cents. You ungrateful people now, it's, you know, I don't know, 75, 85 cents now. So that's inflation work, right? That is an increase in the general level of prices of candy bars. That's inflation. And it turns out inflation is ignored in most engineering economics analyses. We'll ignore it here unless you're explicitly asked to include inflation, and that is very common across the board in engineering economics. In fact, in economics, sometimes in general. But it's still good to know about inflation because it's an important component to what a dollar can buy today versus tomorrow versus 10 years from now. So if you wanted to measure inflation, how would you do it? You could look at the Consumer Price Index, at least in this country. That's a monthly index that reflects changes in the prices paid by urban consumers for a representative basket of goods and services. So literally what they do is they pick out some specific items that you might buy as an urban consumer, you know, a gallon of milk, loaf of bread, that kind of stuff. And they track the average price over time. They can actually, you can actually break this down a number of ways. There's urban, there's rural, there's U.S. in general. You can do it by city, you can do it by location. They just track those over time. And then they relate those to an index year. In this case, index 1982 to 84 is 100. So they relate that to an index. And the way this index reads now is, you know, whatever they cost in 1984 right here, this same basket of goods now costs over twice as much. Simple index. You can actually go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and they actually have a consumer price index inflation calculator. So you can enter in your 25-cent candy bar in 1980. And using the consumer price index, they can tell you it costs 67 cents today if it goes up in relation to the consumer price index. Yeah.
Doesn't WatchDog have like a construction index like this that can be used for?
Are you looking one slide ahead?
No.
Okay. Yes, they do. That's a good question. I'll get to that in 1 second. You're absolutely right. Actually, two slides ahead. That's a good question. So the consumer price index is that basket of, you know, regular consumer goods. It has some relevance to, let's say, construction, but not a whole lot, right? You know, in the basket of goods, they don't have like 1,000 pounds of rebar. Not too many people buy that on a daily basis. But there are other indices that you can do as well. The consumer price index is one that people are typically familiar with, and that's a good general gauge of overall inflation. So what's overall inflation right now? Damn near zero. Right, we're all afraid of deflation. So construction cost indices, you can do that if you're interested in construction. This comes from Engineering News Record. They put these out once a month. But they have, here's the 20 city index. It involves 20 big cities. 1913, the index is 100. And current construction cost index as of January 2011 is 8,938. So yes, inflation is taking hold in the construction industry as it does most places. There's a labor index as well. Labor's gone up by more than that. There's building cost index, there's materials index, there's a cement index, there is, so on and so forth. And you can track that index over time. Yeah.
The wage per hour went down?
The wage per hour went down from the last month. That's not an index. That's dollars per hour absolute wage. Average, which doesn't really mean a whole lot. But typically, if you're working on federally funded or partially federally funded contracts on Davis-Bacon wages, you're probably looking at even your flagger is probably earning about $18 to $20 an hour, if not more. So there's an index for construction stuff, if that's what you're interested in. If you're interested in transportation, you can do that. Everybody's got their indices. These all reflect inflation, basically the reduced buying power of a dollar or the increased cost of things. Here's WatchDOT's one. So this is the construction cost indices index that WatchDOT has. They track their own. They track what the Federal Highway Administration used to track up until 2006, and they lost funding for it, so they don't do it anymore. And some other states that they asked around to. And you can kind of see that that's indexed to 1990 is 110. So right there. And then now, so in relation to 1990, things cost roughly twice as much as they did 20 years ago. This is 2010, end of year. And you can see a lot of the increase occurred between sort of 2002 to 2006 or 2008. So there you go. And this basket of stuff is pretty simple. They look at the cost of cubic yard of crushed aggregate, a ton of hot mix asphalt, a cubic yard of Portland cement concrete, a cubic yard of excavation, and a couple of other things. Pretty simple index. Okay, so that's inflation, but we ignore inflation, so there you go. Hopefully you don't ignore inflation in everyday life, right? When you get a job and you get paid the same amount from year to year, inflation makes that your paycheck actually comparatively smaller, right? If you make $50,000, now you're an engineer. If you make $65,000 this year, $65,000 next year, granted the $65,000 next year is not going to buy you quite as much, is it? Because of inflation. Make sense? Okay, there was somebody had a hand up.
I was wondering how much of that index, the increase in the index, you think was related to fuel prices, because it seems like around 2002 is about when we're seeing things climb above a dollar into $3 territory.
Yeah, some of it has been, yeah, definitely you can tie a fair amount of it, you can tie a good chunk of it to fuel prices, but not everything. Cement underwent basically a worldwide shortage for a while as China sucked up a bunch of cement, so to speak, and other areas too, and we didn't quite produce enough. That seems to be leveling out now. Fuel cost goes directly into the cost of transporting those types of materials, and also kind of indirectly into the production of hot mix asphalt, but not as direct as you might think. So, yeah, that was a big deal. That drove a lot of that. And there was just a construction boom here, right? So demand drove a lot of it. If you want to trust me, I had a bathroom addition put on my house in 2006 and 2007, and that cost a boatload of money, and I could get probably two bathrooms for that now. Don't want two bathrooms, so. But demand has a lot to do with it as well. Risk. So one reason you don't want to give me $100 now and I'll pay you back in a year is that $100, due to inflation, isn't going to buy you the same thing, right? Things will just, your candy bars will be that much more expensive. So that's one reason why you might hesitate to give me that money now. The second one is risk. And the definition of this, at least in relation to engineering economics, is a measure of uncertainty and its effect on future income and expenditures. So risk is a real complex field of study. We could spend a whole class, and in fact, if you want to major in industrial engineering, you could spend the better part of your major talking about risk. So in analyzing options in engineering economics, though, it turns out, we often just assume the risks of different alternatives to be equal, but that's not the case, right? No. Risk kind of gets at this idea. If you lend me that $100, what's the probability I'm going to pay you back in a year? I mean, right, there's some probability, some finite probability that I'm not going to. Right? This is, banks deal with this every day, right? They make a bunch of loans. They figure that a certain percentage of those loans they'll never collect the money on. So the interest rate they charge on those loans has to take that into consideration, that risk that there's a certain amount of loans that they're never going to collect any money on, so they got to cover those from all of us that do pay our loans back. How about that? So that's risk. Risk changes over time, and this is an example how risk works maybe in a particular project. It's a very schematic example. But you know, if you're looking at a particular engineering project early on in life when you're just planning what you're going to do, you don't have a whole lot of detail about what's going on there. So there's a certain amount of things that you know and that you can quantify. You know how big the project is, how long it's going to take. You can do some basic stuff. You know that there's going to be some slop in there to allow for design changes. Like, okay, so we want to do this now. It's going to change a little bit. That'll probably cost us more money. We don't know exactly how it's going to change, but typically it does. So we'll allow for that. Then there's kind of what they call the known but not quantified, or the known unknowns. So you know that maybe there is some risk out there, but you haven't had the time or the money to quantify those things. Okay, so you know that there's some kind of risk. And then there's the unknown unknowns, which is, you don't even know what's coming down the pike at you, but something weird might happen that when you look back on it, you could say, yeah, that was a risk, but I had no idea that even existed. You might include tsunamis in nuclear plant design, but maybe not. But then as you get more detailed in your project, as you start spending more money and more human capital in figuring out the details, you can start to quantify more of these unknowns. And so you can raise the amount of stuff that you know, you can shrink this design allowance, and you can start shrinking these unknowns. All the way till when you go to construction and when you're finished, obviously, when you're done, you kind of know everything. You know what happened, and you're able to quantify all those things. Probably a little late to make any decisions, but that's the case. The idea is that risk changes over time, depending upon how much you know. You can spend the money up front to know more, but that's money spent to mitigate risk, and sometimes it's not worth spending the money to mitigate that risk. Here's one way that WASHDOT does it in their cost estimates. This is the Washington State Department of Transportation. This is what was done a while ago for their 520 bridge replacement and HOV project. But they actually have this cost estimate and validation process, so CEVP. They've trademarked that acronym in case you want to use CEVP. I doubt you do. But what they try and do is they realize when you make a cost estimate for a project, right, the public puts that price tag on the project. You know, when the newspaper asks how much does the 520 bridge cost, they don't want a range. They don't want a probability distribution function, do they? They want a number. Life is about giving people a number as an engineer. So this is how they come up with that number. They say, well, we actually know that our cost estimate involves some uncertainty, and they're going to spend time and effort trying to quantify that uncertainty. So they bring a bunch of experts in for a couple of days, and I go through a bunch of scenarios about, you know, what's supposed to happen, what might those costs be based on if those things are realized, and then develop a probability distribution function that relates to how much they think the project is going to cost. In this case, they think there's a 50% chance that the cost will be, in this instance, actually the cost has grown since, will be less than $2.7 billion. So that's kind of the midpoint, the average, right? So you could report that, but should you? What should you report as the single cost? And so there's a 90% chance, so 90% chance it'll be less than $2.9 billion, 10% chance it'll be less than $2.6 billion. So they're left with this probability distribution, and they're left with that, and then they have to figure out how much are they going to say this project costs, knowing full well that people want a number, but realistically there's a range of uncertainty there. So actually it turns out for the tunnel project, the viaduct replacement downtown, where they've actually just let a contract to build a tunnel underneath Seattle, they reported the 60% probability here, so they hedged their bets a little bit more than the average. And it got reported as, WASHDOT says, 40% chance of cost overruns at project. You can't win. So there's risk involved. And then there's also what we'll spend our time on the next couple of days talking about. There's the cost of money, or interest. So interest is a fee paid or a fee earned for the use of money. More generally, interest is the return on capital. So we'll spend most of our time talking about this. So really, this is, you know, if you lend me that $100, I get some benefit for having that $100 right now, and so I should pay you for that privilege, that benefit. That's interest. So you could charge me interest. Right? Like when I redid my kitchen, my parents gave me an interest-free loan for a year. But not really. They came over to visit several times. So they basically said, hey, Steve, we trust you. We know where you live. However, when we remodeled our kitchen, Wells Fargo did not give me an interest-free loan. gave me a home equity line of credit. The interest rate was 5.5 on that one. So there you go. So some typical interest rates. What does it cost to have money now rather than in the future, right? So this interest rate reflects all these things, inflation, risk, and interest. These all infer the idea that money has more value now than it does off in the future, right? Why do so many people, when they win the lottery, why do they take the single lump sum payment? Even though that single lump sum payment, when you add it up, is less than the yearly payments when you add those up. Because it's got value to have the money now. Because it's yours, you choose what to do with it, you can invest it, you have it now. So you minimize the risk, the effects of inflation, and you can calculate what the interest rate is because the money they give you now is much less than what they would give you over time. We'll do an example this Friday. So here's some interest rates for my bank, basically last week. So an auto loan for a new car, 3-year loan, about 2%. 7-year loan, about 6%. So the bank's saying, look, we trust you less if you take out a 7-year loan. So you're going to have to pay a little bit more. Boat loan, boat owners are shady. 6%. I know a few. Checking account, they actually give me a 0.5%. I make like $4 a year on my checking account. Pretty proud of that. My credit card is, my credit card is only 10%. That's not bad. Let's see. If you want a certificate of deposit, they'll give you 3%. That's not all that great. 30-year fixed mortgage right now, 4.7-ish%. 15-year fixed mortgage, 4.1-something%. Yeah.
What's the APY for
something? Annual percentage yield means they give you the money. APR and the percentage rate means they're charging you. So, you know, there's some typical interest rates. You guys see interest rates all the time. I would say, you know, if there's 20% of the population that knows anything about interest rates, I'd be surprised, frankly. So there are simple versus compound interest. So simple interest on the left, that's interest calculated for each year is based on the initial deposit alone. No interest is computed on the accrued interest. That's simple interest. Now, compound interest, which is what's almost always used, in fact, you know, unless somebody says calculate simple interest, you're always doing this one. Is interest is calculated for each year based on the initial deposit plus all the accrued interest to date. Right? So the interest you earn earns interest. Hooray. Unless you're paying within the interest you have. So that's good. So you can look at the equation here. Don't need to recite the equation. But that's simple versus compound. And we're going to deal with compound interest. That's the way the world works. Money is basically a big accounting system. You can argue which is the correct way of accounting, and you'll never come to a conclusion. The most you can do is all agree that you'll do it a standard way. So the way you do it, it's the same way you do it, it's the same way you do it. And then we can all talk about the same thing. That's kind of how money works out. So I think this might be the only derivation we go over in class. And it's not hard. This is not fluid dynamics. Notice there's no integrals. So you can look at it and say, well, gee whiz, Steve, I don't believe you. Well, now you can believe me. There you go. So period one, end of period value. So this is how we get this number for compound interest. Hooray. You can look at that in your spare time if you really want to. Sometimes there are compounding periods less than a year. Typically, in engineering economics, we deal with a year as a typical compounding period. There's nothing that says you have to, but that's what we typically deal with. So we have introduced this term called nominal interest rate, which is little r. It's an equivalent annual rate that is not adjusted for compounding throughout the year. So, for instance, a good example of nominal interest rate is perhaps your credit card, right? You get charged interest every month on your credit card. Yet they report an annual interest rate. So the nominal interest rate is basically just the summation of the interest rate for each month. Right? So if it's 1% per month, the nominal interest rate over the year is 12%, right? Assuming you guys all know there's 12 months in a year. Yeah. So the Truth in Lending Act, actually that's the act that requires your credit card company and others to report an annual percentage rate. And what they require you to report is the nominal interest rate, which isn't really what you pay. We'll go over that again in a second. So the effective interest rate is an equivalent annual rate that is adjusted for compounding throughout the year. Right, so it's the same kind of thing. So this is going to be a little higher than the nominal rate because you're going to pay interest on the interest you pay. Right, so think about your credit card. If you don't pay it off, at the end of 1 month you pay a fee, interest, and that fee goes on your credit card. The next month you pay interest on what you haven't paid off plus the fee that went on your credit card last month, so on and so forth. So you can relate the two together by this equation here, which is basically a pretty simple equation to do if you've got a halfway decent calculator. So there you go. So let me, now we're at the first example, and we'll start getting a little more example intensive from here on out. Okay. Fire this up. So nominal versus effective interest rate. So a credit card company advertises an introductory student rate of 13.99% APR. So they say APR all the time in ads, so now they have a percentage rate. That's, you know what it means, if you didn't already. Of course, it's after an introductory 0% for 7 months, blah, blah, blah. This credit card charges interest every month. That's pretty common for credit cards. What is the effective interest rate associated with this advertised APR? So the Truth in Lending Act requires them to tell you the APR, or nominal interest rate, is 13.99%. But we want to know what the real, actual, effective interest rate is. So you can use that equation pretty simply. So right, you know, effective interest rate, 1 plus R over big M, all raised to the big M minus 1. So 1 plus 0.1399, right, that's the nominal rate. 12 compounding periods. Some of these, if you, not all of these problems, but from time to time, some of these problems that I work out, I've also worked them out in the notes section. So when you download the PDF, there's actually notes that you can hover over or click on that will show you the problem worked out. Other ones aren't worked out, so that's the benefit you get of coming to class. You get them worked out for you. Okay, so you run all that stuff in, and you get 0.1492 of 14.92%. So, they're required by law to tell you the nominal interest rate, but the actual effective interest rate, this is what you really pay over the year, is 14.92%. And the reason they require you to tell it to, if you think they should require you to tell, you know, tell you what the effective interest rate is, right? I mean, that's what you're paying. But it turns out, for most folks, they have no idea what effective interest rate is. Not many people are going to go to this equation. Nominal, most people can figure that out. You're charging interest every month. There's 12 months in a year. 12 times that interest every month is the nominal. So from a marketing point of view, most people actually do understand that. So that's why they require you to report nominal rather than effective. But, you know, you're in civil engineering at the University of Washington, so you're already sort of, you know, if the average person is here, you're already up here. You guys got to know effective. So there you go, effective interest rate. It's a little bit like fluid dynamics. We worked the problem out, didn't use any integrals, so it's not totally like fluid dynamics. So we'll work one more, and then we'll call it a day. So payday loan. You're short on cash. You apply for a payday loan from the local branch of Money Tree. You wish to borrow $700 for 15 days with one single payment of $7.95 made at the end. I took these are real numbers off Money Tree's website. What are the nominal and effective APRs? What do you guys think? So here we go. So we're charged $7.95. So actually we're charged $95 for that loan over 15 days. So we're charged 13.57%, right? That's how much we get charged, 95 over a $700. Okay, so this occurs every 15 days, so to speak. There are 365 days in a year. And every 15 days is a compounding period, so there's 24.33 compounding periods per year, right? Every 15 days. So the nominal rate is just 24.33, number of compounding periods, times the percentage for each one of those. So the annual percentage rate for that loan from the Money Tree is 330.16%. That's why people don't like the Money Tree. They have some reasons for saying, hey, you know, it doesn't matter, it's a short-term loan, our risk scale is totally different, which is true. They're taking risks that banks typically don't, so they need to charge for it. Now, what's the effective interest rate? One plus R over M to the M minus 1. 1 plus R is 3.3016 divided by 24.33 to the 24.33 minus 1 is 21.11. So that is 2,110%. Okay? So that's why people don't like the payday loans, right? Because this is a very typical APR that you're paying. Compare that to your mortgage at, you know, 4.6%. It's big, big money. But then again, this is different, right? These guys are taking different risks. If you're taking out a mortgage on your house, you're one level of risk. If you're getting a payday loan, you might be a different level of risk. So they have to cover those things. So there you go. Now you can figure out how much it's costing you for your payday loan at Money Tree.